In the extraordinary circumstances of the COVID-19 pandemic, TNI and its allies are working to continue to bring you radical analysis of the most pressing issues of the day. Join us for our weekly webinars. We bring together excellent experts to discuss how this pandemic health crisis exposes the injustices of the global economic order and how this crisis must be a turning point towards creating the systems, structures, and policies that can always protect those who are marginalized and allow everyone to live in dignity. The COVID-19 pandemic has led many governments to release an unprecedented number of people from prison and curb new admissions to prevent deadly outbreaks in prison and other detention centers. The pandemic has exposed the societal costs of mass incarceration, while the quick actions taken by governments cast doubt on the necessity of imprisonment for those released. The following is a recording of a webinar where panelists look at the drivers of mass incarceration worldwide, sharing analysis on the impact of COVID-19, the negative impacts of imprisonment exposed by the pandemic, and the challenges and opportunities it provides for sustainable reform. What strategies are available to civil society to reverse this long-standing trend of mass incarceration as a response to crime?
Good afternoon, good evening. Thank you so much for joining us today. I am Dania Putri from the Transnational Institute, and I'm speaking with you from Rabat, Morocco. Welcome to this webinar on COVID-19 and the global fight against mass incarceration. So today at this webinar, we will look at the drivers of mass incarceration worldwide with a particular look at punitive drug policies. These policies have been driving up prison numbers in so many parts of the world. So today we will be sharing analysis on the impact of COVID-19 and how this pandemic has exposed the various societal costs and the unjust nature of imprisonment worldwide. We will also discuss the many challenges and opportunities for sustainable reform. But before we proceed, I think it is critical for us all to acknowledge and share our grief, pain, anger, and determination at the events currently happening across the United States. The tragic suffering and death of George Floyd and too many others across the US and around the world have recently reignited people-led movements to counter racist policies, police violence, and the unjust nature of our criminal justice and economic systems. So I'm sure we will have more discussion about this later in this webinar, but I hope in doing so, we will always remember that we are talking about human lives and we're talking about genuine human experiences and not merely as statistics. Okay, so this webinar is co-organized by the Transnational Institute, or TNI, the International Drug Policy Consortium, or IDPC, the Washington Office on Latin America, or WOLA, and also Penal Reform International, or PRI. We'll be joined by speakers from different parts of the world. So thank you so much and welcome Olivia Rope, Isabel Pereira, Sabrina Mahtani, Maidina Rahmawati, Andrea James, and Justin Moore. I'm also very happy to announce that this webinar is also being interpreted into French and Spanish. You can find the interpretation button below at the bottom of the screen. Special thanks to our interpreters for this and also for making it possible for more people to follow this important discussion. Also, my colleague Nicolas will be sharing some important links and resources in the chat room. As some of you know, TNI has been working on drug policy issues for about 20 years. And this is also another reason why we're organizing this timely webinar together with WOLA, PRI, and IDPC. So if you'd like to know more about our work, there will be some links and resources being shared in the chat room. Also, if you'd like to support our work, please consider making a donation to TNI. And for that, you can also find the link in the chat. All right, so for the format today, we will hear a short initial presentation, about 5 to 7 minutes from our five panelists. And then I will ask some follow-up questions, and then we'll have a little bit of a discussion. And then afterwards, we will move on to read some questions from you all, from the audience. So you can share your questions anytime during the session via the Q&A option at the bottom of the screen. You can converse with each other in the chat room, but if you would like to share, to ask questions to the panelists, please write them in the dedicated Q&A platform. So without further ado, let me introduce you to our first speaker. Olivia Rope is Director of Policy and International Advocacy at Penal Reform International, where she leads on policy setting and advocacy with international and regional bodies on a range of human rights and criminal justice issues. And she also acts as a spokesperson for the organization internationally. Olivia has authored key publications and training materials for PRI and worked extensively with UN and other institutional actors and partners. She also worked at Amnesty International previously and also at the EU office in Brussels and in their New Zealand section. So thank you so much, Olivia, for joining us. Welcome. The floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Dania, for the kind introduction, and welcome to everyone that's joined us today. I'm really pleased to be part of this discussion, and I'm going to get right into the substance because we all have a lot to share and ponder together. I do have some slides that will hopefully pop up in a minute. I think the starting point on any discussion around decarceration and criminal justice reform and in this COVID crisis is really that the global prison global prison world was actually in crisis before this pandemic hit us. And I'll set out a few numbers to expand on that. So now we have 11 million people globally in prison. And this is the highest number recorded yet. The numbers keep increasing, and the reasons for this growth are complex, and there are some regional variations, of course, but what is clear is that people are not becoming more criminal. We documented in our new Global Prison Trends report published last month that crime rates are relatively stable or they're going down, yet the number of people in prison continues to go up, with the exception of in Europe. And this has brought severe levels of prison overcrowding. Over 100 countries operate above their maximum occupancy rates, and 22 are operating at more than 200%. More people, unfortunately, does not bring more funding, and so the scarce resources that are available just have to be stretched even further. And the mortality rates for people in custody are at crisis levels, and this was before COVID-19. There are the mortality rates are as much as 50% higher than for people outside. The trackers have showed that there have been over 62,000 people in prison infected with coronavirus across 77 countries, and there have been over 1,000 deaths recorded across 31 countries. But the data is not always available, it's not made public, and testing is also an issue. So these numbers really, we believe, are the tip of the iceberg. They also don't include other detention facilities, and prison staff are not included, and we know that they have been affected. People in prison are vulnerable to coronavirus outbreaks because of the overcrowded conditions, the lack of healthcare provision, etc., and also because the WHO recommendations around hygiene and social distancing are virtually impossible to follow. Because of this, one of the first calls that we made when the pandemic was declared was to reduce the number of people in prison. And this needs to happen both at the admissions, so through halting or curbing the rate of admissions to prisons, and also putting release mechanisms in place. So where we're at is Human Rights Watch has estimated that approximately 580,000 detainees worldwide from around 80 countries have been authorised for release, which does sound like a lot, but actually it's only around 5% of those detained globally. And it's important to note that this has to be caveated with the fact that many release orders have not been fully carried out. There's been a lot of announcements, less action. Many are temporary and people will be called back to prison. And in some places, the releases happened but were not matched with reducing admissions. And so we've seen the front door still open, receiving people, while the back door let out a few. In saying all of this, we do believe that together we can harness the decarceration initiatives for longer term reform. And this is not least because there has been an increased awareness of the fate of people in prison and the crisis state of justice systems in many countries. And in some respects, acknowledgement from the public. Coronavirus has shed the light on prisons and justice to some degree. So where do we go with all of this? Well, I think in assessing decarceration efforts that have happened, we need to look at who is in prison in the first place and what are the drivers of rising prison numbers. So you've mentioned drug policies. Alongside this, we see pretrial detention remains the norm and not the last resort in many places. Since the year 2000, the number of people in remand has grown by more than 30%. It's also clear that prison is increasingly being used for non-violent offences, and alternatives to imprisonment are looked upon as a second inferior option to prison. And we see that there are an estimated 50% or more of people in prison for non-violent offences. And prison has been used as a response to more and more types of crimes. The starkest example is with prohibition-based drug policies. Over 2 million people are in prison for drugs offences, and 500,000 of those are there for possession for personal use. Women, minorities, foreign nationals, and other groups are disproportionately impacted by these policies. Secondly, and related to my first point, we need to look and understand how these releases and population reductions happened, the mechanisms, criteria applied. We've seen amnesties, pardons, releases with various conditions like electronic monitoring, and some prison administrations have even been involved in identifying and drawing up lists on who should be released. But in other states, very strict criteria was applied at the executive level. Mm-hmm. Where did drug offences come into this? We've seen mixed responses. Places like the Philippines have largely excluded drug offenders, unsurprisingly. And others, like in Jordan, those convicted of drug use alongside minor financial crimes were released with some conditions. So I think the point is how can the groups of people that were released or were eligible be kept out of prison in normal, regular times outside of COVID-19? Mm-hmm. I need to conclude. So I will end by just on a thought about where we need to go, and that is looking at non-custodial alternatives imprisonment. Keeping in mind the purpose of prison is rehabilitation, and this needs to be alongside decriminalisation efforts. There's a lot of good examples out there that show that fair, proportionate responses to crime are actually the most effective, and we need to, urgently reform our systems before more harm is done.
Mm-hmm. Thank you
so
much.
I'll leave it there, Dania, and hand it over to my other panelists.
Yes, thank you, Olivia. You definitely raised some important points there by highlighting these global patterns. So we'll get back to you on that for sure. So now we're going to learn about the situation in Latin America. We're going to zoom in a little bit. So let me introduce you to our next speaker, Isabel Pereira. So Isabel is currently the research coordinator of the drug policy area of the Center of Law, Justice and Society Studies, or the Justicia. Additionally, Isabel is a member of the Research Consortium on Drugs and the Law, or SED, and she's also a member of the Advisory Board of the International Drug Policy Consortium in representation of the Latin American region. Welcome, Isabel. Thanks a lot for being part of this webinar. Over to you.
Thank you, Dania and colleagues. I'm happy to be part of a all-women panel, even if it's virtually. And good morning from Bogota for the organizers to making this happen. Thank you. And before diving into the content, I would like to thank the members of the research consortium you mentioned, which TNI and WOLA are partners to, because they helped me prepare much of the information and analysis I'll be sharing with you today. So in the Latin American region, when COVID hit, we're in a context of profound inequality. And while quarantine measures would put in early on, they're not sustainable because there's not a basic income. That's for another discussion. But in terms of prison, as Olivia mentioned, we were in an already protracted state of crisis in the prison systems. And if you can show this slide, please, on the table of the SED. So this is the information of all of the countries the SED is made up. And as you can see, all but three countries do not have overcrowding in their prison systems related to the prison capacities. And even the case of Mexico, which appears to be okay, it is actually not when you zoom in. And there are at least three like great horrible mistakes that the governments are making in their criminal policy design and in their implementation with very questionable effectiveness on its set purpose.
So Isabel, excuse me, I'm really sorry, but would you mind speaking a little bit more slowly so that—
That's okay. I tend to do that, sorry.
No worries.
So this first mistake in the criminal policy design is the excessive use of pretrial detention. As Olivia mentioned, this goes against the presumption of innocence. This should only be used in exceptional cases. But in the case of Argentina and Bolivia, as you can see, in Bolivia, 64% of the population is in pretrial detention. In Argentina, it's almost half of the prison population. And then there's the issue of drug policy as the second big mistake. This is the exclusion of certain offenses from alternatives to incarceration. In many of the Latin American countries, drug-related crimes cannot be applied any alternative to incarceration, so automatically there is a prison sentence. So this makes up for the fact that a significant portion of the prison population in Latin America is made up of drug policy offenses. Most of them are minor, not violent, and of people from poor socioeconomic background. This is the case, for example, of Ecuador, with almost 30% of the prison population from drug policy, drug offenses. And then the third great mistake is there has been an exponential increment to prison sentencing in the last decades. This is something that the SED has studied at length. So for example, there's a very similar sentence to rape or genocide as the sentence, the maximum sentence for a drug offense. And you can only imagine that the harm caused by one offense is not equal as the other, so it's very unproportional that we're giving these sentences. When COVID hit the region, one of the first decisions in the prison systems was to suspend family visits. And this has been very complicated for prison systems because family members are the sole providers for people within prisons for basic necessities, for basic toiletries, for soaps. You have to bear in mind that in the prisons in Latin America, there is no running water permanently. The medicines or foods they're giving out are sometimes very often expired. So all the basic necessities that people in prisons depend on are from the family members. These measures sparked protests, at least in three countries, in Argentina, Colombia, and Venezuela, and in confrontations between prison officers and the prison population, there is sadly a death toll of 69 people. Some measures have been put forth to decarcerate or relieve the prison overcrowding. Some have been amnesty or pardon laws. The case of Mexico, for example, is quite interesting because this was an amnesty law presented last September, but it was only approved now. It was refused back then, but it was approved now because of the pandemic. And the problem with this amnesty law is that the mechanism by which people can be released has a lot of bureaucratic hurdles, and it can go up to 6 to 8 months to release. So it doesn't make sense that the mechanism was not modified through the pandemic with the urgency of state we're in. There are also laws and decrees to release by pre-existing conditions or people or elderly people. But all of this share the same problems, that they're slow in their implementation, so they will not respond to the urgency that we have at the moment, that their scope is very limited. So for example, in Colombia, the decree can only release 4,000 people, but the prison overcrowding is of 40,000 people. And that they exclude some of the offenses that actually cause overcrowding, specifically drug offenses. What are the voices of activism from the region? So there are like three types of networks that are trying to make this change, and this has been going on for a while. It's not because of the pandemic. So the first are the networks of incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people. There's a very interesting experience in Colombia with Red de Mujeres Libres. This is a network of formerly incarcerated women that are both doing advocacy for women in prisons and also networks of solidarity for those being released or for those still in prison. And they were very active when the protests sparked in just showing what was happening within the prisons. There are also the networks of families of people who are incarcerated. This is the case of Argentina with ASIFAT, a very interesting experience in advocacy. And then there's just organized civil society with organizations such as De Justicia, Corporación Humanas, a lot of feminist organizations in the regions. And what these organizations are trying to do is take this all this work through strategic litigations to try and get the courts to order governments to do something quickly. With all of this group of networks of activism, some good decisions have come up. So in Colombia, there is a law, this decree that I mentioned before, that is very narrow in its scope, and that is being followed up by the Civil Society Strategic Litigation Group. And then in Peru and in Costa Rica, people who are deprived of liberty now presented a measure of amparo, like a measure of going to the courts for a fundamental right being violated. These two people in these two countries have pre-existing health conditions. And the constitutional courts in those countries order the governments not only to solve the problem of that particular person, but of the overall situation in prisons. So you can see how these different networks of activism come together and sometimes through high courts make up for somewhat positive decisions. Yeah. It's not sufficient yet. Very few people are being the dangers that you have mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And then this all brings up to light the failure of just conjoining this idea that putting up people in prisons will get us a better sense of security. As you know, Latin America is one of the regions with the highest rates of homicides and all other insecure security problems. But there's this false idea that we can solve it all through prisons. And as the recent years show, this is extremely ineffective. So I just will give it away now to the rest of the panelists and hope to engage in more of a discussion later on. And thank you again for the invitation.
Yes, very interesting, Isabel. Thank you for sharing all those important examples and activities that are happening in the region. So next, for the next speaker, we will hear from Andrea James. So Andrea is the founder and executive director of the National Council for Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls. She's also the founder of Families for Justice as Healing, and author of Upper Bunkies Unite and Other Thoughts on Mass Incarceration. A former criminal defense lawyer, she was a 2015 Soros Justice Fellow and recipient of the 2016 Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Award. So Andrea will give a short presentation, and she's also joined by her colleague from the National Council, Justin Moore, AKA Taz. So Taz served 16 years in a federal prison. She's one of the co-founding members of the National Council for Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls, and she's also the director of training for the National Council. So Taz will also share her input later. And a very warm welcome to you both. Thank you so much for being here. Andrea, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Danya, and it's wonderful to see all of you on this incredibly important information time. Isabel, it's wonderful to see you. I am very happy to be here. We have been working with Coletta Youngers and for quite some time now. in regard to, sorry, there's been a lot of protesting going on around here and I'm losing my voice. In regard to the work that we do, we in 2010 were women who were incarcerated in a federal prison here in the United States in Danbury, Connecticut, the federal prison for women in Danbury. And we heard in around that time in 2010, the increase in dialogue around the need to end mass incarceration in this country. And we heard very little as we were total in the prison. We made up about, that prison at the time was overcrowded and had about 2,000 women in it in the entire prison. And we heard this uptick in dialogue about the need to end mass incarceration. However, we heard nothing about women, and we heard nothing about our children who we had left behind. And so we decided in that prison to begin to organize ourselves as incarcerated women, to use our voice also, though, to use our experience as incarcerated women, as women who had come to prison, and also to use our voice based on the ideas for better policy that we had. And the more work that we did before we even came out of the prison, really, we grounded ourselves in understanding about the issue of racism as the underpinning in the United States for the criminal justice system. We really refer to it as criminal justice. We say the criminal legal system, because there is really nothing just about it. And the levels of complexity that racism and classism plays. Our criminal legal system is built off of a system of slavery. It is built off of a system of oppression and control of Black and Brown people in this country that continues today. And the prison populations in the United States reflect that. Black women also now being part as women of the most increasing incarceration population in the country right now. This is after 40, almost 50 years of massive incarceration, over criminalization of predominantly African American men. And the women in our communities being left behind to hold up the families through all of the incredible levels of economic and familial disruption that has been caused by decades of incarceration and targeting of Black and Brown communities in the United States. So historically, racism has played an incredible role in how Black and Brown people are disproportionately represented in the prison populations. But also when we look at where spending and investment has been allocated in the communities that have been targeted for this war on drugs that has carried on in this country for decades now, the investments we see clearly now have been made in building prisons. We had an incredible prison boom in this country where from 1990 to 2006, there was a prison built every 10 days in the United States. And those prisons are crammed full now with Black and Brown men and women. And so we are very clear in this country in terms of the policies and who they are directed toward. But as incarcerated women, again, in 2010, we decided that we were going to use our voices to create change. And we started in the prison and we brought our work outside with us. And you'll hear more about that work from our director of training, Taz, Justine Moore. But we really came out of that prison with a goal to end incarceration of women and girls. And that's a massive goal. And back in 2011, when we started to come out and do this work, it was a goal that marginalized us. It was too fringe, it was too radical, it was abolitionist. And so we were pretty much marginalized because of it. It took us a lot of years, many years, to get that term and that goal of ending incarceration of women and girls to be acceptable. And now in the United States, you hear it everywhere that folks are now working to end incarceration of women and girls. And we're very happy about that. But we are adamant about making sure that the most directly affected women and girls who began this work to decarcerate and to end incarceration of women and girls continues to be led by the most directly affected women and girls. And so it took us a few years to figure out how do we operationalize such a massive goal as ending incarceration of women and girls in a country like the United States, the most incarcerating country on the planet. And we came out with our long-term work known as Reimagining Communities. Reimagining Communities, we named it that, was a collective process that took us 2 years of going around the country and listening to incarcerated and formerly incarcerated women and girls and putting all of their thoughts and ideas for what they need in their communities, including in the prisons, because our communities don't stop at the prison gates. Our communities include our sisters inside. And taking all of that information and coming out with this long-term plan, Reimagining Communities, and we named it that because in this country for years, there has been a narrative that's been shaped by large nonprofits to reimagine prisons. Well, those of us who are directly affected and formerly incarcerated and currently incarcerated, quite honestly, we're tired of reimagining prisons and we want something different. And so we've named our long-term work Reimagining Communities. And we've been going about developing that and implementing that and working more with our international sisters as well and the incredible work that we've developed with Coletta and mostly our Latin American sisters and now building that out to sisters all across the globe to talk about this because the story of the women are all the same. Whether you're in the Bronx here or Harlem or Roxbury in parts of the United States or you're in Bogota or Argentina or Brazil or other places that we have had the privilege of visiting. Mm-hmm. But then COVID hit we were already working on clemency, which is a process that can allow the governors or the president of the United States to commute a person's sentence. And we have been successful under the Obama administration, working to push many women out through President Obama's clemency project. And so we were continuing that in state prisons to encourage governors around the country to commute the sentences of elderly women, of women who were pregnant, of women who are considered what we call survived and punished, meaning they are serving sentences and they are victims of and survivors of interpersonal harm and violence. And then the other category were long timers, women who had just been in a prison and they're just buried in this prison. They've been in there for decades and they need to come home. Women who are terminally ill. And so when COVID hit, we knew that we had to move very quickly to begin the process of petitioning and fighting to ramp up that clemency campaign to get those women who fit particularly in those four categories, particularly our elderly, particularly our young women who are pregnant, and particularly our terminally ill women out. And it's been quite a battle. We have been a part of amicus briefs. Our senior legal counsel, Catherine Chevchenko, has helped to file lawsuits. We've had to challenge based on the constitutional Eighth Amendment against cruel and unusual punishment. We have a federal government, a federal Bureau of Prisons that has actively tried to thwart the release of people, even after creating a memo from the Justice Department defining who should be released. These things have bottlenecked and not happened. Many state governors aren't even acknowledging that COVID exists. And so we are in an incredible battle here in the United States. And the COVID, what it did though, is to lay bare for the entire world to see all of the inadequacies and ineffectiveness of the systems that we have, how they don't provide for the needs of human beings. Mm-hmm. Excuse me.
Yeah.
And finally, I wanted to just point out that we are also dealing here in the United States with the death yet again of another Black person, of another African American killed at the hands of the police, Mr. George Floyd, and our condolences again go out to his family. But this is an ongoing and becoming a regular and consistent occurrence within our police departments against Black communities, killing both men and women. And so it has sparked unrest. It has sparked uprisings. It has sparked protests. And what we are trying to do through our work at the National Council is to, yes, recognize that, but to help to remind our members and our organizers to stay focused on the work at hand, because we have to connect the dots. As the country now is focused on this, and as people are talking about defunding police departments and defunding racism, we are using this opportunity to connect the dots so that people understand that defunding racism means ending incarceration of women and girls.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Wow, Andrea, thank you so much for raising all those experiences and your advocacy efforts with the National Council. And I think we're definitely going to have more questions and discussion about that a little bit later. But I think it's fair to say that you've raised so many important points with regard to the systemic nature of all the problems happening right now in the US and also in other parts of the world. Yes, so let me bring our next speaker, Sabrina Mahtani. So Sabrina is a British Zambian human rights lawyer with over 15 years experience in the human rights field. And she's also a specialist on women in the criminal justice system. She co-founded the award-winning NGO Advocate, which provides access to justice, education, and empowerment for women in contact with the criminal justice system in Sierra Leone. So welcome, Sabrina. Looking forward to learning about your work in the region. So over to you.
Thank you so much. And it's a real privilege to be here with some of these, you know, distinguished speakers. Many prisons in Africa across the continent are old. They were built during the colonial era and they're severely overcrowded. So for example, in Sierra Leone where I work, there's an occupancy rate for prisons which is 220% of capacity. And in Zambia where I'm from, it's 300% of capacity. And this creates huge problems for access to healthcare and hygiene facilities. In the maximum security prison in Sierra Leone, there's one doctor for 2,000 detainees. And in most prisons that I visited on the continent, there's challenges with running water and sufficient soap. So as Olivia said, you know, this makes it incredibly difficult to have social distancing or even, you know, have good hygiene in terms of preventing COVID. Also similar to Latin America, on the continent, we have significant problems with pretrial detention. In half of African countries, 40% of the prison population are pretrial detainees. And many people are arrested for minor offences, particularly women. Theft, owing money, loitering, which is an offence often targeting sex workers. And we are pushing, and many organisations on the continent are pushing to decriminalise petty offences. You know, poverty should not be a crime. And women make up between 2-9% of the prison population, but as they're small in number, they're often neglected. And most prison facilities lack facilities for women. And many women will be imprisoned with their young children. So in response to COVID, we did see many countries releasing detainees in an effort to reduce overcrowding. The most common mechanism used was pardons or early release. And the criteria varied. It was, you know, pregnant women, those sentenced for minor offences, those with 6 months left to serve on their sentence. So for example, Ethiopia released 4,000 prisoners, Senegal over 2,000 prisoners, Kenya about 5,000. And in Kenya, this was done through judges expediting hearings using Skype. But this has been insufficient, it's been too slow, and it's been too few. For example, in Nigeria, 70% of the country's prison population are pretrial detainees. That's almost 50,000 people, but only 4,000 prisoners have been released. So more definitely needs to be done. In Sierra Leone, there was a detainee who tested positive for COVID. He had been arrested for larceny, so again, an example of a petty offence. And this resulted in a protest in the prison due to some restrictive measures that were put in place. And tragically, 11 prisoners died and 2 prison officers. And this has become really politicised, and so it's been very difficult now for us to push for releases of prisoners. And we now have 11 prisoners infected with COVID. It's been really difficult for us to push for the release of pregnant women. A few weeks ago, a woman gave birth in a hospital and she went back to prison. We have a woman currently in a police cell who's pregnant, and we're pushing for her to be released. So it's been really challenging, but like Andrea said, we're still battling along. And we've seen these acts of protest by prisoners across the continent due to similar fears and concerns of COVID in South Africa, in Nigeria, in Cameroon. And sadly, we've also seen prisoner infections on the continent, in South Africa, in Cameroon, Guinea, Morocco, and DRC in prisons there. And as Olivia highlighted, we're also having challenges with new arrests due to lockdown laws and state of emergency legislation. Our paralegals in Sierra Leone regularly monitor police stations during lockdowns, and we see women being arrested for going to buy water or being out after curfew, but it's because they can't find transport to go home or not wearing a mask. And so we're constantly like trying to negotiate with police officers to release women. And this is also happening in other countries. In Kenya, we've seen at least 6 people killed by police when enforcing lockdown measures. And so we're seeing in some countries a law enforcement rather than a public health approach. And there's going to be a webinar tomorrow on petty offences in West Africa and these new offences which are being created to police lockdowns. And Advocate's legal manager will be speaking. So in case any of you are more interested in that topic to hear more. And I think the civil society has been playing a really important role during the pandemic through public advocacy. We've seen over 30 civil society groups across Africa, from Malawi to Nigeria, calling on governments to release prisoners. But also through private advocacy, speaking to judges, speaking to those involved in the public health community, trying to broaden the coalitions that we work with, so it's not just people working in the justice sector. And the statements we've seen from the UN, from WHO, from the African Commission, these have been really helpful, and these have been persuasive when we try to speak to policymakers. So I really hope that after this pandemic is over, that these entities are going to continue their calls for decarceration, because it's really important to have their voice on this issue. We've seen civil society providing urgent supplies for detainees. This is vital. When family visits have been suspended in many countries, it's so important that civil society groups can provide these items. Just 2 weeks ago, we provided medicines and PPE to the health unit in the Sierra Leone prison, and the doctor told me that he didn't know how he was going to be able to continue, you know, a week on without these supplies. We see civil society adapting to be able to provide legal advice remotely, you know, trying to provide legal advice to people in prison through using telephones since visits have been stopped, or as I mentioned, monitoring police stations and doing that vital work. Also, civil society are trying to amplify the voices of incarcerated people. An Advocate will be putting out a piece in a few weeks where we're trying to highlight the concerns and views that incarcerated women themselves are feeling in Sierra Leone. And really, no, legal systems are on the front line of this pandemic, and civil society groups need to be supported, they need to be funded, and they also need to be included in the COVID response and recovery plans. And I don't think we're seeing this enough. We're not seeing civil society be consulted about this. So I'm going to stop there, but, you know, happy to answer any questions later on.
Perfect. Thank you, Sabrina. And yeah, it's very interesting to see the overlap of advocacy efforts and civil society and community-led work that I think you, Andrea, and Isabel have shared. I think it's definitely going to inspire more people to consider these efforts and extend cooperation as well. So yes, so I think this connects very nicely with our next speaker from Indonesia. Hi, Maidina. So Maidina is from the Institute of Criminal Justice Reform, or ICJR, excuse me. So at ICJR, Maidina works as a program manager, researcher, and lawyer, focusing on advocacy work related to the protection of vulnerable populations. She works on drug policy reform, protection of victims, and gender perspective advocacy in Indonesia's criminal justice system. So Maidina, would you like to share the situation in Indonesia? Over to you.
Okay, thank you so much, Dania. Thank you so much for TNI that having us, ICGR, in this very important webinar. I just like to present about the prison condition in Indonesia. I have slide maybe. Yeah. Okay. We can start by the context of Indonesia because on the of recording situation in Indonesia, since we have the open data on prison situation in Indonesia, we already faced the problem of prison overcrowding until February 2020. We have the occupancy rate in 203%, which become a very serious problem when it's come to COVID-19 and also virus outbreak. So we have met the causes, the driving factor, what leads Indonesian criminal justice system to overcrowding situation. We divide it in three aspects, from entry point during imprisonment and also the exit point. The entry point is about the criminal policy in Indonesia, like for example, the Olivia shared previously that in Indonesia, specific in Indonesia, we have very very punitive criminal policy. Our legislation, 39% our criminal our legislation consists of criminal punishment, that our government tends to have the punitive law that every aspect of social aspect related to social problem include the criminal punishment as a law enforcement. It's also the problem is reflected in our war on drugs as well, because of we have so many punitive drugs policy that sends more than 40,000 people who use drugs to jail, that we have the prison population 68% that from the drugs offenses. We have also the problem of pretrial detention, the overuse of pretrial detention, and our alternative to detention, for example, city prisoner or home arrest, is not effective. Like our bail system is also ineffective, and we don't have we do not really invest the strengthening how to strengthening the probation official in Indonesia. So the entry point is the problem of entry point is of on the criminal policy itself, and also the problem of implementation, the overuse of pretrial detention, and no alternative to detention. And also, during the imprisonment itself, we have the problem of a population distribution. Not all the districts in Indonesia have a sufficient facility to provide a prison. So the problem is become more complicated. That many regions have the problem of overcrowding very dramatically, and also. The budget to build another new prison is difficult. It's hard in Indonesia because we have so many. We have spent 50% of our budget, Ministry of Law budget, for the meals for the prison alone. So we don't have any resource to build another prison to address the problem of population distribution. And also in the exit point, the problem is we don't have any transparency process in the parole or integration program request. So basically, in exit point, our law provide any mechanism for early release, but we don't have any. We don't have really any transparency process. It's corrupted. So many research in Indonesia that says that the process to request a release is complicated. That sometimes it can be corrupted, and also. Like Isabel said, also there's some policy that exclude specifically on drugs offenses. Like for example, we have our government regulation that restrict the request for the imprisonment period reduction, simply because of the convicted is from the drugs offenses above 5 years imprisonment. So it become more complicated when it's come to the exit point. And also the mechanism of assessment is doesn't really work because the prison the population is we have so many people in the prison. So our probation officer, our correction officer cannot do the assessment well. So when it's come to the release, so the process of assessment is lacking. And also we want to share about the advocacy. The next slide, maybe. the advocacy that we already done with the government of Indonesia. The good side is the government of Indonesia already aware about this prison overcrowding since 2017. The government that Joko Widodo administration has focused on how to reduce the number of prison overcrowding. Like for example, in ICE, since 2018, ACGR focused working together with our Ministry of National Development planning that we promote the restorative justice in the respect in the Indonesian value that one of the aim that we why we promote restorative justice is because we want to reduce the number of prison overcrowding. We will mainstreaming the idea that punishment and criminal extension is not the only solution for the government, also for republic, all the social matter in Indonesia. So we built our own consortium with other NGO in Indonesia, working close with our Minister of the National Development to systematically and strategically reduce the number of overcrowding in Indonesia, and we succeeded. In 2020, we have the idea to promote restorative justice, to promote how to optimize the alternative to detention is included in our national medium term development plan in 2020. So we can do the advocacy because we know the agenda of the government. Mm-hmm. And related to COVID-19, we have succeeded to do the advocacy to release the next slide. Yeah, to release more than 40 inmates from the prisoner because of the context in the context of COVID-19, because of problem on overcrowding become undeniable and urgent. So the government already see the problem. We just give a recommendation to the government to accelerate the efforts that has been done by the government previously to make it more to accelerate the advocacy. So in May 2020, we succeeded to push the government to release 40 inmates from the prison. But we see that there is some critical aspect in the government policy, because why? The process, like for example, the assessment process, one of the critical aspects that Isabel says that the security aspect also become a problem, because in Indonesia it's also become a problem. There is a fear, public fear that some of the inmates that has been released reoffended some crimes, that it can be blacklist in our advocacy effort, and also related to the category of the inmates that should be released. So basically in March 2020, based on the decision by the government, the inmates that has been released is not focused on the vulnerable groups. Mm-hmm. It's only focused on the people in the prison based on their prison period, imprisonment period. So it's not focused on the how incarceration impacted to vulnerable groups. So we now focus on our next advocacy to urge the government to focus on the vulnerable groups to make it more rigorous assessment, and we can start it by do the complete assessment to vulnerable groups. So yeah, it's long gone, really long effort of the advocacy, but we can still push the government because they are already aware with the problem. We just need to do it more with our civil society because we have succeeded. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so in total, there have been 40,000 prisoners, mm-hmm. inmates who have been released, but there's still a long way to go, and mm-hmm. More work is to be done soon. Thank you, Maidina. So, I would like to spend the next 10, 12 minutes or so to ask some follow-up questions to our panelists. So for the audience, feel free to put your questions in the Q&A platform. Let me just quickly start with Isabel, because you mentioned that some people, some prisoners have been excluded from the release measures and from amnesty. So I just wonder if you could describe what are the implications of this exclusion, and you know, have you seen any movement or reactions from inside prison as well, similarly to what Sabrina has described in African countries? Can you talk a little bit about those implications?
Sure. Thank you, Dania. So I went over this briefly, but the exclusions of drug offenses is a pattern across the region, and this specifically targets women, because most of the prison population, of the female prison population in Latin American countries, is made up of women. It's the fastest growing prison population across the region in countries like Costa Rica, Peru, Ecuador, Colombia. So if you compare, for example, drug-related offenses in prison, in male prisons is 12% and in female prisons is 45% in the case of Colombia. And this is a similar trend across the region. So when you exclude drug offenses from the decarceration laws and decrees, you're basically excluding half of the women from these decarceration measures. Mm-hmm. One of the strategies that was taken up is the case again here from Colombia. We have a special mechanism in Colombia, because back in 2013, the prison crisis was declared by the Constitutional Court as in a state of unconstitutional matters. This is sort of like a riddle. And by this ruling from the Constitutional Court, a civil society mechanism was created. So the civil society mechanism is made up of numerous civil society organizations. And when the decree came up, in the review process at the Constitutional Court, there was an intervention to present this issue of proportionality and how it impacts these specific populations that are usually women from poor backgrounds with low levels of education that are the sole caregivers and caretakers of their family members. So the link to that intervention has been shared there, and we hope to hear from the Constitutional Court soon.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. And I think in relation to that, it's also important for us to hear to remember what life in prison is actually like for millions of people across the globe, right? So, yeah, Taz, maybe may I ask you to share your personal experience being in a federal prison in the US? And also feel free to share a little bit about your advocacy work with the National Council.
Yes, hi, thank you. First, I'd like to thank y'all for having me on this panel. So appreciated, and I'd like to say hi and send love to all my international family. I served 16 years in a federal prison. I went in prison in 1998, and I came out of prison Christmas Eve 2013. During those 16 years in prison, it was horrible. I spent a year back and forth from different county jails, where the food, of course, is horrible, the conditions as far as the sleeping arrangements, because you're right next to a person that if I reach my arm out, I can touch that person. The officers treated us very bad. They don't respect you as being a human being. And before I go in a little further, let me just say that for language wise, we try to refrain from using the word inmates, because that is a label that was put on us by the system to dehumanize us. And in order for us to humanize each other and our families on the inside, we cannot use that language. They are incarcerated people. They are humans as we are. So, you know, just to bring that to light, that please try to refrain from using that word. It also was one of our leaders who sent out a letter before he passed, Eddie Ellis, who gave us that information to not use that word. We have to humanize our people, giving homage to Eddie Ellis. Moving forward, during this COVID, I think a lot about the people that I left behind in prison that are still serving life sentences for any crime, whether it's violent or nonviolent. And I think about how right now prison is a death trap, because you're sleeping in bunks that are next to each other that are less than what they want, a social distance 6 feet away. Some of these bunks are right next to each other. And if you're on the top bunk, if you reach your hand out, you can touch the person that's next to you. And in the prison, they didn't have hand soap in the bathroom. They definitely didn't have hand sanitizer. They didn't, though, they don't have bleach, the things that we are needed right now in this pandemic to help us bring down some of the passing of the virus. And it devastates me to think about what my sisters have to go through during this time. And that is why our fight for clemency to have our sisters released is very important to us. Now, this is a fight with the National Council for Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls. We have been fighting for years to release our women and girls, to have our people released from prison. COVID just highlighted the necessity to have our people released. And it's a shame also because we have one of our sisters that is actually on the outside, a formerly incarcerated sister, one of our coworkers, that's sending in toilet paper, hand sanitizer, soap, mask for the women inside the institution. So if a person on the outside, a formerly incarcerated person on the outside, have to send these essential needs inside the institution, that is enough to let this world know that the prisons cannot take care of us. They're not equipped or financially equipped to take care of us. And it's a problem. It has always been a problem. I also want to talk about Andrea spoke about the importance of clemency, but what I realized here in America is very hard to get our governors to move to utilize their clemency power. And the clemency campaign is a campaign that we started in the beginning of 2019, way before COVID, because we saw the need to have our elderly released, our people that we knew that were infirm, that were sick in prison and dying in prison. Every single day, there's a woman dying in prison. And we have to bring them home. Prison does not rehabilitate us. It does not help us. It does not give us anything that we need to step out back into society to live a regular everyday life. One of the things that I do is I do what is called participatory defense. That's one of the things that I train in and one of the things that we work in. And it was started by D-Bug out of San Jose, California. And what participatory defense is a community organizing model that helps families, people incarcerated, and the communities navigate through the court system to get the best outcome. Because we know that the court system, if you're standing in court by yourself, the court system will destroy you and they will give you any amount of time that they think because you do not know the law and you do not know how the system works. So with participatory defense, that helped people that's been in prison, going up for an appeal, that's going up for parole or probation. We help them navigate through the system by creating different tools to help them get the best outcome.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Taz. And thank you so much for pointing out that very important remark regarding language. And I think it's also something to learn from me and for so many other colleagues and participants here. So thank you again. Maidina, would you like to share a little bit, very briefly, about prison situations in Indonesia?
Yeah. Okay. Prison situation in Indonesia, like Isabel already shared in the previous presentation, it's quite the same in Indonesia. We have the problem of the basic supply. Like for example, in Indonesia, the prisoner does not provide the water supply permanently. Like for example, in Jakarta, even in Jakarta, in the capital city of Indonesia, the problem of the basic supply, like for example, the water itself, it cannot be accessed permanently. And also we have the problem of the health condition. We have so many insufficient health workers. We have the health workers that health workers, one health workers has to be responsible for at least 36 prisoners in Indonesia. and not all the health workers in the facility provided by a doctor. So basically in our law, it should be consist of the doctors, psychologists, and also nurse. But in the facility, even worse in facility in capital city of Indonesia in Jakarta, not all the facility provide doctors. So the problem is because of the basic supply and also related to the health problem. So when it's come to the COVID-19 context, it can be worse because our system, our health system, even our general health system is not ready for this outbreak. Yeah. Even worse in our prison system.
Thank you. Yeah, and I think from the presentations of all the speakers, it's clear that the impact of certain punitive policies have clearly a disproportionate impact on not only communities of color, but also poor, marginalized communities. This has, of course, very horrible repercussions. But I think it's very interesting in my view that in so many parts of the world, in Asia, North America, Latin America, the level of drug-related imprisonment has been very, very high. But this has not been the case in African countries, for example. So I wonder if Sabrina, maybe you could share some thoughts on that and perhaps some insights as to how recent release measures could actually pave the way for longer term penal reform on the continent.
Thank you, Dania, and thank you so much, Taz, for your important remarks on language and just sharing your personal experiences. That was really, really important. I think that the reason we don't have as many people sentenced for drug offences in Africa is broadly due to geography, because of the international drug trade and the war on drugs, which we've heard Isabel and Medina speak about. But it is increasingly becoming an issue, particularly in West Africa. And in 2013, the West African Commission on Drugs put out a report saying that, West Africa is now the new hub for drug traffickers. And IDPC has done a really good study looking at some of the drug laws in West Africa. And the predominant approach is punitive. And there's definitely a need for reform. There's definitely a need for more humane and harm reduction approaches. I mean, even in our work in Sierra Leone, we see this. We often see women who are arrested for selling really small amounts of marijuana. And this is mostly a survival thing. They're doing this because of poverty. They're doing this to create an income. It's not something that they should be in prison for. But there has been some positive steps. Like in Ghana, there was a new law passed this year which offers alternatives to incarceration for drug users rather than criminalization. But really, I think that this is a bit of a neglected area, and I think we need a lot more kind of research and attention to this issue on the continent. And then just quickly going to your question about, how these releases can stem the way for like longer term penal reform. Mm-hmm. I really hope this is going to bolster efforts to decriminalize petty offenses. Like poverty should not be a crime. Most mm-hmm. of the people who've been released, they should not have been in prison in the first place. And I really hope as well that this is bringing more visibility to de-incarceration, and it's going to make it a greater priority for governments. Mm-hmm. And I've been really encouraged by the strong coalitions we've seen on the continent, organizations, different movements coming together, sharing information, sharing good practice examples, and standing alongside each other in solidarity, not just on the continent, but globally. And I think this is what we really need. We need to build on this momentum. We need to come together. We need to learn from each other post-COVID.
Yeah, very important indeed. So Olivia, since you're focusing on the global overview, can you tell us, maybe have you come across any countries that have done it right or could provide some best practices for the rest of the world?
Yeah, that's a good but difficult question. I definitely don't have one kind of perfect case that I've not seen, and I think a lot more analysis is needed, but there has been a couple of good ones, I guess. But in Ireland, we've heard from colleagues at the Irish Prison Reform Trust that they have seen very swift and I think importantly coordinated action across the government very early on, and there has been reported zero cases in prisons. They have seen the women's prison population was reduced by over one third, and overall 10% of the prison population was released.
Mm-hmm.
With support mechanisms in place and so on. And I also would want to highlight Italy, where over 1 month there were about 160 people being released every day. So there's been quite a lot of unfortunately, prison health is connected to the public health system, which also makes a difference. So, you know, it's kind of a reminder, actually, that prisons aren't over there and society is here. Actually, prisons are part of society, and people are cycling in and out. I think there's a lot of thought that needs to go into how we explain that better to the wider public. And COVID-19 has kind of provided that platform to some degree.
All right. So before we start reading questions from our participants, I just want to get some quick thoughts, maybe from you, Andrea, or Taz, or another panelist. As we have seen some people, you know, who have been released from prisons in many countries, there have been instances in which once they have left the prisons and then they're going back to their communities or their cities and families and all that. But we've seen instances in which people have actually been rejected by their communities, mainly because of stigma related to incarceration and right now also COVID-19. And at the same time, they get very, very little or even no support at all in terms of healthcare and housing and many other services from the government. So I just wonder if you could share a little bit on how we could address this more systemic structural issues and make sure that in advocating for prison reform and criminal legal reform, that we're not leaving anyone behind. Any thoughts on this? Perhaps Andrea? Or
here in the United States, actually, it is the people, the families in our communities that have been most directly affected that have been the reentry support for people coming out. We have less of an issue with people not being accepted. These are our loved ones. These are ourselves. I came back into my family when I left prison. We all have been supported, those of us who have family. The problem is that there are a number of people who are coming out, mostly not because of being released because of COVID, because that's not really happening at the level as we've heard other countries are doing, but just mostly because people serve their sentences and they come out and they don't have the support because legislation and policy has been put in place in this country, in states and in city, through city and state governments that preclude people from living even with family members if they family member lives in, say, public housing, meaning housing that is supported by the government. They have put restrictions on even privately on people who rent houses and apartments so that those restrictions don't allow people with felony convictions to come and live in those places. And the women mostly who are the leaseholders of these places are threatened with eviction if they are found to have people with felony convictions, particularly drug felony convictions, living in their homes. And so this is a problem for us because we're right now going through a budget process at the National Council. We have our sisterhood that is across the country that are working on people's budgets. And what we're finding as we're going through all of these individual state budgets is that it's a very austere investment that's being made in behalf of in supporting people in reentry. There are great barriers that people have to overcome upon reentry. It's very difficult to get a job. We have thousands and thousands of laws that preclude people from getting licenses and things that could be used to start their own businesses, such mm-hmm. as barbershop licenses and hairdressing licenses and all of these collateral consequences of being incarcerated. And so we've got still, those things are still in place. And the government does not invest, our state budgets don't, and the federal money coming into states does not support people who are formally incarcerated. And that level of disruption that's caused as a result of this in their lives after prison often is the underlying cause for people to recidivate. It's not because people just automatically return to whatever, you know, transgressions led them to a prison bunk. It's that people have no resources to create a new life for themselves, to feed themselves, to house themselves. Our homeless population in this country is outrageously high and growing. And it's showing that entire families, women with their children. There's an incredible group in Oakland, California, of mothers who literally took over privately owned housing that was just being left empty in order to house their babies. And a full force was taken out against them by law enforcement in Oakland for doing that. But they won the day because they stood up and they said, we have every right. We are human beings and our children need a roof over their head. So the real problem in this country is not that our communities won't accept us when we come back. We do. We want our people back. We want to demonstrate what different looks like. The resources, though, to support people upon reentry are pretty much non-existent in an effective and adequate way, led by the community, not led by further government entities, which is what we're fighting for, shifting those resources through reimagining communities and providing the money and the investment in treatment and housing and education that our people need as they come home. Let me just end here to say the last piece of that difficulty has been this incredibly draconian piece of legislation that has been passed in the United States on the federal level called the First Step Act. It is just a prison reform bill. It doesn't reform prisons at all. We call it the capitalist prison industrial complex bill because the only people that have actually benefited from that are people who are investors in our prison complex. And that's one of the problems. We have an administration and we have people here that fought to push that bill through. We needed much larger criminal justice reform shifts in this country. It was an affront to just focus on prison reform. And the tiny percentage of people that bill is providing relief to. Not that we're not happy if everybody, one person alone gets out, yes, of course, but we need so much more than that in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think this is a very suitable bridge for our first question from our audience. And this relates to most of the things that you've raised, Andrea, especially with regard to punitive populism and criminalization of poverty and the privatization of prisons, the prison industrial complex in general. So I think I will give this to Olivia because this relates to also prison release measures around the world as a response to the pandemic. So the question is, how can this measures, how can we ensure that these measures also address some of these systemic issues that have been raised today during the webinar, like criminalization of poverty and institutionalized racism and the lack of state support for communities and populations in general. Could you maybe shed light on what kind of efforts we could do to make sure that there are real systemic permanent changes for the future?
Yeah, I can try. I think the first thing that comes to mind is we've been discussing what has touched on in terms of support for people that have been in prison. And I think kind of I've seen some statistics from the US and also from Indonesia where the levels of reoffending were incredibly small, negligible. And so I think it's really up to civil society and advocates to kind of gather that type of evidence to show these people never needed to be in prison in the first place. And this is what happened when they were released. Like the world didn't fall down, and actually there wasn't even a rise in crime. And so that's something that perhaps, you know, others might have more kind of specific thoughts about. Another point is really around decriminalisation and proportionate sentencing. So I think there's, you know, step by step, and there's a lot of examples out there with drug offences, for example, and also petty offences from the Americas and Africa, especially where you literally change one tiny bit of a law and then a lot of people are released, or a lot of people will not be going to prison in the first place. There is a real movement to think about who is actually being charged in the first place. And a lot of that, a lot of the kind of institutional racism and so on that goes with that, that's, you know, bigger, broader reforms. And it really does take a lot of courage and a lot of broader reforms. But in terms of looking at COVID-19 and the releases, I think we really need to, like, while we can really take the political will that we have seen and start the discussion back into prison and people under those kind of offences or those categories like the ill, the elderly, people that, women that are pregnant or women that have small children, they shouldn't be going to prison in the first place. So if they were released, then that would be my starting point. That's where we would be looking to come in.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, let me just go back to the US for a second here, because there's a very interesting question. Maybe Taz, you can answer this. As Andrea said, in the US, there have not been any release measures. In fact, there have been more arrests happening since the protests have started across the country. And I think with your work with the National Council, you talk a lot as well about fighting for a world without incarceration for women and girls. But also there is, some people have heard of discussions about creating a world without police. I wonder if you could share some thoughts on that and explain a little bit what it entails.
Okay, yes, one of the things that we are working on is called transformative justice, or the transformative process. And what that is, if something goes on in your neighborhood or in your area, you don't call the police. The community comes together and decide how to handle things. And just to give a small example so maybe people can understand clearly, let's say a couple is having an argument and sometime it gets physical. A neighbor may call the police. But what we're trying to create now is that we have maybe someone else can be called in the neighborhood to de-escalate the situation. Because 9 out of 10 of the times, if it's just an argument, after everybody's calmed down, they're going to go back to being a loving family. They're going to go back to still being in a relationship. So with transformative justice, we're learning ways to not call the police. Because when the police come, we know somebody's going to jail. We are trying to create our own ambulance company. So when something goes on, we don't have to call the ambulance, because if you call the ambulance, police come. And it just gets involved. So with transformative justice, we're just trying to picture, step outside of the system. And everything that goes on can be handled in our neighborhoods. We're trying to go block by block to have a safe house on that block. If something is going on where maybe the parent feels like, I just need a break from my children, that someone in that house will be able to watch your children for a little while she takes a parental break, just a mental break. And we just don't want to call the police anymore. And if we organize within our neighborhoods, our hyper-local neighborhoods, to work on this transformative justice process, then we can do that. Well, we can handle things in our own neighborhoods. We do not need officers coming to interject what we can handle ourselves. But we have to come together as a community in order for it to work.
And to add what Taz is saying, as part of that transformative justice work that we're doing, we're coupling that with the participatory budgeting projects that we have, that women from hyperlocal neighborhoods, from the most directly affected by the criminal legal system neighborhoods, are coming together to look at the state budgets again, because we have a disproportionate number of levels of funding going to law enforcement and to prisons. And so, for instance, in Massachusetts, in the state that I live in, our governor right now is proposing a $40 million increase to the Department of Correction, $92 million to purchase police vehicles, a $50 million new women's prison, millions more dollars to build a new county jail. That's just within one state. And so we have to know this. We have to consistently be paying attention to what's happening on the fiscal side of legislative policy that's being proposed. And we're in a fight now using a participatory budgeting process that's led by formerly incarcerated women to say no to these budget line items. You must shift that money into our communities so that we can fund the types of projects that Taz is talking about, transformative justice that addresses interpersonal harm amongst people, individuals in our communities, and increasing what we refer to as community accountability, so that we have less interaction and engagement with law enforcement, and all of the money that just has been going year after year to them and to prisons now is shifted to our communities.
All right, very interesting, yes. Yeah, let me just read one more question. We've received so many questions, so thank you so much to everybody who shared their questions. Unfortunately, we're almost at the end of the webinar, so let me just ask this one question very quickly to Isabel. Somebody in the audience wonders if maybe you could share some thoughts on the particular challenges that incarceration presents for LGBTQI people, and in particular trans people, especially in this pandemic.
Yeah, thank you, Dania, and I've enjoyed hearing Andrea, Taz, Sabrina, my Dania, Olivia. Thank you all. I've learned so much from you. To the question, I actually chatted with that person and sent them the report coming from the IDPC, WOLA, and the Justicia, but okay. Nonetheless, so we did a small policy brief on the situation of specifically trans people in prisons across Latin America. Mm-hmm. Of course, as suspected, there is the issue of discrimination, and it makes you wonder whether there's specific measures being put in place for that population right now among mm-hmm. COVID, and I believe not. And on the contrary, across Latin America, what local governments are doing about this population is deepening discrimination. Actually, in many cities in Peru and in Colombia, the quarantine measures were based on sex. So you could either go if you were female one day and if you're male one day. And this led to specific targeting of trans people by the police, even by just guards at supermarkets. This same kind of discrimination that is put forth in the prison systems, it comes from just societal discrimination, and local governments are sadly deepening by the the social control policy measures during the quarantine. So it's actually being more complicated right now.
All right. Okay. Thank you so much for sharing that. So we're almost at the end of this webinar. So before we conclude, I would like to ask our panelists, perhaps if you could share in 20, 30 seconds, do you have any final message for activists and people around the world who are in the same struggle to end mass incarceration? So in very briefly, 20 seconds or so, what universal message would you like to convey to them? Maybe Olivia, would you like to start?
Sure. I was thinking that as well as in the long term, but anyway, for reform, I think we urgently need to highlight and support right now. We see that so many millions of them are in lockdowns, cut off from families, very little information. It's an incredibly anxious and awful time to be in prison. And so I think that it does provide an opportunity for us to show the human side of prisons, and is that really what societies want for people who in many cases have committed minor crimes and in any case presumed innocent in pretrial detention and serving ridiculously long life sentences, which is completely inhumane. So I just would, send out a message of support and ask everybody to really highlight the plight of people that are in prison today in this awful crisis that we're in.
Mm-hmm. All right. Isabel?
Yeah, one takeaway is that governments usually say that there are no resources to social policies, but how come do they have these massive resources to sustain the criminal legal system? So I'm inspired by the experience of the US in chasing the budgets and seeing how to reallocate those funding to real policies that serve the people, to fund civil society, who are the ones who have the expertise to build a community into responses to just human problems.
Yeah, indeed. Taz?
Yes, I would like to say reimagine your community, imagine a world without the system being involved, and also stay in contact with the women and people that are incarcerated inside, because those are the voices that we need in order to move forward on the outside.
Mm-hmm. Sabrina?
I guess my takeaway is solidarity. I think we need to continue building on the momentum of this. We need to come together, from networks of formerly incarcerated women, civil society, public health people. We all need to come together on this. And please, if myself or Advocade can be of support to the work you're doing, please do reach out to us, particularly if you're on the continent, but also globally. We need to continue to be building a global movement on decarceration.
Perfect. Mai?
Yeah, I think the problem is because of the incarceration also affected to the work of the government. So when it's come to the problem of the mass incarceration, so it could be something that we keep doing the advocacy with the government, because we can see that the impact of the mass incarceration faced by the government. So the government must need the cooperation with the civil society. So we just need to push the government more and more to do the advocacy, so it can be something that we can succeed in the advocacy to reduce the overcrowding.
Yeah, Andrea.
I would just say center the people who are most directly affected in the work, whatever the work is that you're doing. Center incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people in that work. And I do say incarcerated people. We don't often understand that incarcerated people have ideas. They need to have their voices amplified and uplifted. They have solutions. And every project we do at the National Council includes incarcerated women and girls. And so we encourage everybody to remember that, but also for those of us who are on the outside doing this work, if you're in an organization and you're doing work around criminal justice reform or abolition, and you don't have the most directly affected people on your staff, you need to think about that. You need to create space to bring in and to center and to give leadership roles to people who have the direct experience. It's very important. Mm-hmm. And also want to just say thank you again for centering us in this conversation and for helping us to build and grow upon the work we're doing to amplify the voices of women around the globe. So thank you.
Yes. Thank you, everyone, for sharing such a powerful message today. I really appreciate it. So I think we've learned so much today. Thank you again for our wonderful panelists for their generosity and sharing your experiences and knowledge. So we really hope that discussion will continue along with all the important advocacy work that many of us are doing. And also, thank you so much for everyone involved in the process of organizing this webinar. All my amazing colleagues from TNI, from IDPC, WOLA, and PRI. And last but not least, thank you. Thank you so much for everybody for attending. So, and we really hope that you would be able to attend our next webinar as well. It will be on the 10th of June, also at the same time as today. It's titled Taking on the Tech Titans, Reclaiming Our Data Commons. And for this webinar, we'll be joined by Ben Tarnoff, Anita Gurumurthy, and other activists and researchers to look how to stop COVID-19 reinforcing the power of big tech. The sign-up link can be found in the chat box. And once again, if you'd like to support our work, please consider making a donation to TNI. The link is also available in the chat. And also, we're keeping the chat open for the next 10 minutes or so, so you can conclude your conversations and copy all the relevant links that you would like to collect. And yes, so once again, thanks so much for all our wonderful panelists. And thank you so much all for tuning in. See you next time. Bye-bye.